All right. Rate regulation.
Hey. Thanks, Hans. Good morning, everybody. This is the last session of the board meeting, and it's paper number 13. Person, and I hope that's not a bad omen, but we'll see how we go. We've got two papers to discuss at this session. Paper 13A deals with some sweep issues that have arisen as we've started to draft the proposed interim standard that we discussed at the last meeting. Paper 13B is on a different phase of the rate regulated activities project. It's looking at the research phase of the project, and we're looking for the board's permission to publish a request for information to help us to scope the discussion paper that we're planning to publish later in the year. But first of all, dealing with the sweep issues, at last month's meeting, the board made various decisions on the detailed proposals for the interim standard, which would allow first-time adopters of IFRS to continue their existing local gap policies for the recognition, measurement and impairment of regulatory deferral account balances. And consequently, the board has also decided that because those balances will only be recognised by that limited population of entities, there will be isolation of the impact, and those balances, therefore, will be recognised just in three line items in the financial statements. The total of the debit balances would be recognised immediately after a total asset subtotal in the balance sheet. Similarly, total of the credit balances will be recognised as a single line item immediately after total liabilities. And in the statement of profit or loss and other comprehensive income, all of the movements on those balances will be recognised as a single line item immediately after profit before tax. This raises several application issues that have come to light during the drafting of the standard. So this paper, therefore, tries to go through, and we're going to seek clarity on the board's views on how these interact with some existing standards. With the exception of the deferred tax proposal in paper 13A, we've tried as closely as possible to respect the decision, first of all, to allow the continuation of existing recognition, measurement and impairment policies, but at the same time to be as consistent as possible with the other standards that are already in existence. And it is a very difficult balance, which is why we're here to discuss them again to seek additional clarity. I suggest that we go through each in turn, but I think it would be helpful as we go through each one to keep in mind that we are trying to keep this isolation. We're trying to keep this at-a-glance comparison between those entities that will be recognising the regulatory balances in accordance with this standard and those entities that won't be recognising the balances in accordance with existing IFRS. So the first proposal is...
Can I say something before you get to the first proposal? Jane, you and I talked about it, so if I come across being rude, it's not my intention. You know that. When I read this paper, I just felt something which is very akin. I felt that it's almost like we are treating this as a second-class citizen. You're allowed into the clubhouse, but you're not allowed into the swimming pool, into the gym. You know, it just feels that way. I feel that this board, however painful it is, and you know I did not vote for it, but I chose not to dissent on it at the same time. I think we have made the decision. Just once we made the decision to allow those assets, however painful it was and however close it was, I think we have to respect the decision and go from there. I just feel that, you know, this isolation is kind of like, you know, you got to wear the badge all the time. It's like, I just feel that I think there is a little bit of that, and I don't mean it in a disrespectful way, but I just feel that I think we got to, at some point in time, accept it, move on, and it's an interim standard.
Isn't this the description that you gave, isn't that the situation that we there is an application for membership, but we're not sure yet.
But we allowed, though. We allowed it for the time being. We'll allow you. You are an interim. You are into the membership. So I feel that way, because otherwise I think we are constantly questioning. Because some people are dissenting because it is an asset or a liability. And if I remember right, Martin is dissenting because he doesn't like the interim standard per se. And so it's an amalgamation of it, but we live with it.
My feeling is the reason why staff propose this or that is because it's impossible. It's hard to isolate. This is why staff propose to isolate some, but not isolate the other. This is the difficulty. This, to some extent, from beginning, I feel whether it is operational. For simple companies, isolated in a small county, with only one submission, it's easy to do. But for a giant giant utility company, it's not so easy.
We have already decided to try to isolate these issues. So.
Yeah, but I think once we, what I'm trying to answer, and I'm trying to be helpful, and don't get me wrong, all I'm trying to say is that once we isolate it, all the issues, the answers can be different. EPS, you cannot show it this way, UPS, you know, it's like...
Well, it could be that, you know, once you try to do it operationally, it's such a mess that you decide, okay, well, let's get it over and done with. But in principle, this, you had a basic problem with the approach. That decision has been taken.
That's why I respect it.
So I think the issue is now, can we do it in a proper fashion or not? If it's just too much of a hassle, or we think
it's too much of an isolation,
cannot be done properly. But that is a very different question from how you worded it. But
how I worded it?
You had what you worded was that you have a basic problem with trying to isolate all these effects.
And no. You're not understanding carefully. I said, once you admit it, don't keep on isolating it. Let it go. That's what I'm trying to say.
We had decided that we wanted this interim standard, but we were going to try to isolate.
I think the important thing to what Pika is saying, and I think there are definitely some points in here where that's a valid comment. What we wanted to do, we didn't want to isolate for the sake of isolation. We want to isolate so that there is comparability between those entities that prepare under IFRS, call it normal, and those that apply the standard. And that's what we're trying to achieve. Where it does come in is sometimes it feels like we may not be necessarily allowing entities to report their regulatory balances under what we would call best practice. So the isolation of something like earnings per share, to my mind, is absolutely valid. Because that's the only way that you can compare something that's prepared under IFRS and something that's prepared under the standard of IFRS. And that gives you that comparability. Some of the other things that come through with the IFRS 5 and those sorts of decisions, I have a little bit of a concern with, and I think that comes to what PK is saying, is that we need to give people the ability to report those numbers in a way that is consistent with IFRS, but at the same time true to our objective of trying to achieve that comparability.
Like I say, it's a very difficult balance to try and match the two sides.
But it suggests that we might need to think about expanding
I think we have to find the middle ground. We should permit people to understand the impact of the regulatory assets by segregating. But going as far as saying you must exclude them from your EPS number puts a shame on the figures. It must be wrong if you have to exclude them. That must mean those figures are meaningless, means we don't like them. So it's already taking a position. So I would say middle ground would be to say, okay, when you publish EPS, then you should have an information, a note, what is the impact of those regulatory amounts on the EPS. So you would have EPS before regulatory impact and after.
So we're now already, because you're talking about the first question, which is fine.
Well, which is, the philosophy of this document starts very well with the first question. It gives the lead to what we want to do or not to do. So I think it's, in my opinion, we should find a middle ground saying people need to understand the impact, but to require that it's kind of eliminated is just going a bit too far because we have not taken a view yet.
Yeah. Perhaps if I could just respond to that, Mary, before you come in as well, because like Han says, we're now in the discussion on EPS. I mean, the staff proposal does try and get this comparability by saying that the headline EPS figure should be comparable with those that are not recognising these balances. Within IAS 33 itself, there is already a permission to disclose additional EPS figures other than those that are mandated in the standard. And what the staff recommendation was saying is that if we make the mandatory EPS figure the one that's comparable right the way across the board, these entities recognising regulatory balances already have the option they can bring in with the same prominence, which is what it says in IAS 33, it's the same prominence, you can bring in an additional EPS figure that you can then explain why you're showing the differences. Perhaps a slightly softer approach to give the same authority is that we could amend IAS 33 to make both of those measures mandatory. So instead of saying one is the mandatory, the other one is an optional extra that includes these regulatory balances, we could say, you know, give them the same prominence, make both of them a disclosure requirement.
That was my suggestion to you. So.
Well, with this small change.
Wait a minute, about the process to do it. You propose to amend IAS 33. Is it really necessary to open up IAS 33 or to say if you are using this interim standard, which is a specific standard,
go both.
Then the consequence on you is that if you present EPS, then you present it this way. I will not open IAS 33 per se because we have so many questions with IAS 33 which we have left open. And we have decided some time ago not to touch this standard, which is poor. So I would try to segregate it from IAS 33 itself.
Mary? A general question, kind of going back to PK's challenge about this paper. I think I'm glad that the staff has brought this paper and flagged the issues that I think we need to decide to make the interim standard operational, because I think we have said our conclusion is a permission to do this based on your previous gap, but we want isolation. If we don't go through and specify, not in exhaustive detail, but and answer these questions, which I know the staff has sat down and thought about, where is their interaction, I think our interim standard will not produce any degree of comparability amongst those who are taking the option. Forget about before you get to those who did not, you know, who have not recognized these segregated balances. So I think it's the right thing, you know, I think it's the right thing to do. I think we should go through and answer these questions and include the guidance that's, you know, the result of our conclusions in the exposure draft to make it operational. And on then going specifically to question one, I support the staff recommendation. I do have some concern about the alternative that you've just raised about going and amending IAS 33, because I thought we were trying to keep this as quick and focused as possible and not start having a lot of consequential amendments. Which would include not having a lot of consequential amendments to other standards.
I think if we go for the alternative approach, which is to make both of them mandatory, we can do that without touching IAS 33. We just make it an additional disclosure requirement within the interim standard. So that would work.
Stephen?
I agree with what Mary and Jane have just said. Just something for you to think about in drafting. You also need to consider the effect on non-controlling interests. Because you're saying exclude the amount for the regulatory asset charge credit, but NCI has to change as well.
Yeah.
Can we agree with the slightly modified proposal by Jane?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay. This doesn't get any better, I think, as we go through these. But discontinued operations and disposal groups, in IFRS 5, we've got a similar sort of issue. But this case, I think we need to split it into two separate steps. IFRS 5 deals with two things. It deals with the measurement of disposal groups or assets held for sale. It also then deals with the presentation of discontinued operations and disposal groups. In terms of the measurement, there is already a list in paragraph 5 of IFRS 5 of individual items that are excluded from the scope of the measurement requirements of IFRS 5. these items kind of split into two groups. One is items that are already measured at fair value through profit or loss, because IFRS 5 generally requires fair value, less cost to sell. So if it's already recognised at fair value through P&L, it's exempt from the scope. Also, there's a little batch of items like deferred tax, pension balances, that the basis for conclusions to IFRS 5 say are excluded from the measurement scope of the standard because it's too difficult to calculate the fair value of those individual items. And I think that these regulatory balances probably fall into that second group of items. It's difficult to identify the fair value of these things because they're incorporated in future revenues, future sales. So part of the staff recommendation is that we exclude these balances from the scope of IFRS 5. And I'm not sure I can do that without making a consequential amendment to add a single line into IFRS 5 to add this to the list of balances that are exempt.
Are you sure of that, that you have to amend IFRS 5, which applies to everyone here? We are in a derogatory regime, which is unique, specific, and cannot it be self-contained? All consequences of being in that regime would be part of that standard, which would override, in a way, override the general regime in IFRS 5, as we just decided for IAS 33. Technically, can't we do that, to have a self-contained regime which is all-encompassing?
With the earnings per share item, though, that was about adding an additional disclosure requirement, whereas this is modifying how IFRS 5 is applied to these particular balances.
But there are two ways to go in it. The entry point is that you want to apply the regime for regulatory assets, and then you have a standard that applies to you. The consequences of that, why are not they in that same standard, which would override the general regime of IFRS 5? The problem, I don't want to open up all our standards and make amendments to all our standards, because there may be dozens, just because you apply one particular regime, which is regulatory assets. Can we avoid it?
Let's try. Let's try, and if the staff considers it further and concludes they can't, then they can't, but let's try.
I'm not sure we've got a precedent for doing it that way. But,
yeah, but I agree with you. I think for application would be much easier if we have everything in this. This is an exception, the first time that we do something similar. So I think we should have a go on this.
My concern is that this will apply to a limited group of companies, maybe a lot of jurisdictions. We not even have to consider that standard because they don't have such companies. And to bring into the endorsement process amendments to all of our standards just because of one limited problem in one or two jurisdictions or three is creating a lot of hassle for all those which have an endorsement process. If we could segregate as much as possible that issue.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Do we agree with Philippe's suggestion?
Yes.
Yep.
Very much.
Okay. So, can I also just double check people are comfortable with the recommendation then that we exempt these balances from IFRS 5 in terms of measurement as well, albeit we do it through the interim standard. The second issue on IFRS 5 is this presentation issue, and I do think this is a very difficult balance, but on balance we think that it would be better to retain this isolation and keep the regulatory balances that may well be included as part of a disposal group or part of an operation that's being discontinued, so that we keep in the statement of financial position, in the statement of comprehensive income, this direct comparison, this at-a-glance comparison between different entities. And again, use the interim standard to then pull out additional disclosure, which, again, I think we can do just within the interim standard by linking that into existing requirements in IFRS 5. IFRS 5 already talks about isolating the impact of disposal groups as single line items on the balance sheet, single line items in the profit and loss account. And then it adds additional disclosure requirements that you do some additional analysis in a note supporting those individual line items. So our recommendation is that we use the interim standard to say, leave the regulatory balances within the regulatory line items, but then supplement it with the existing IFRS 5 analysis, and you can link the two together to show the impact.
Would the standard as it stands at the moment, the readings that we've got at the moment, prohibit the entity from breaking that out on the face within the regulatory section?
I think the way that it's been, well, the way that it's been drafted, but we haven't sent it to you guys yet for balloting, because the decision last month was that it was a single line item, it would prohibit it. But you have the option now, you could tweak it so that it was regulatory balances, continuing operations, regulatory balances discontinued.
And that, I guess my concern here would be that if, for example, you're discontinuing most of your regulatory activities, to present a line on the face of the balance sheet that says discontinued operations or assets held for resale, but not actually have that clarification on the regulatory balances, I think is actually misleading. Because it implies, because you've got the line there, it implies that that's not the case. So it suggests that this is something that maybe should be broken.
I'd say it's a very difficult balance, so I'm interested in views.
So we could provide that as a judgment call to be made depending on how significant this matter is in the particular circumstance as to whether it's just in the notes or whether it's also on the face of the balance sheet.
Again, you know, again, linked to our general principle to isolate and let those isolated items be subject to their local GAAP. Assume currently the local GAAP regulatory regime also have similar or have related requirement. How?
What is that? Can you repeat yourself?
Now, if the current GAAP have clause or separate sections related to this kind of transaction, and will the amount of recognition measurement was subject to the regulator's decision, and now if there's no, it's okay. We ask them to follow our standard disclosure requirement. If there is, how should we reconcile? And whether your proposal is fit our proposal that is isolated?
I think, Wei Guo, this is probably demonstrated best through the deferred tax issue in this paper, in that it's how, that my understanding was the board's decision in terms of continuing existing local GAAP is really to determine the balance that's recorded for these regulatory amounts, primarily within the record-keeping system of the entity. But then there is some interaction then how to lift that balance from the accounting records and put them into the financial statements. And there are some cases where there is nothing to do other than lift it physically from one place to the other and drop it in, and there's no more changes. There are other things where there's interactions like the deferred tax, or later on we talk about foreign currency translation. You may well be having this regulatory balance in your internal record keeping system in a foreign currency. How do you then put that into your IFRS financial statements? And my understanding is at that point we're in IFRS financial statements, so we should be applying IFRS policies as far as possible rather than importing lots and lots of local GAAP policies that are not specific to regulatory balances but are more general requirements.
So local GAAP is only used for recognition and measurement. Presentation disclosure is based on the interim standard.
Agreed.
Okay, thank you. The next issue is IS 36 and impairment, and we touched on this a little bit last month, which resulted in the board deciding that The regulatory balances would be outside the scope of IAS 36 and would follow the local gap impairment recognition and measurement policies. However, there is an issue in that there may be circumstances where IAS 36 would require an impairment test on a cash-generating unit, a CGU, that might include these regulatory balances. This could be because, for example, the CGU includes goodwill, and IAS 36 then would require this, the normal annual impairment test for the CGU as a whole. Again, IAS 36, a little bit like IFRS 5, already includes a list of items that are excluded from the individual impairment requirements of IAS 36, and it's a very similar list to the one in IFRS 5, those that are already measured at fair value through P&L, those that it's difficult to measure fair value for. And again, the staff recommendation is in line with the board's decision last month. We keep the individual balance outside of IS 36, but then just leave IS 36 silent on what to do if you're doing an impairment test on the whole CGU, and instead just put some application guidance or a mention in the interim standard to make it clear that once the regulatory balance is within the CGU, you just follow the normal IS 36 requirements, which already does deal with these individual balances that are outside the scope of 36 on an individual basis.
Great. Makes sense.
Okay, next one. I've been dreading this one on deferred tax. I'm conscious of understandability as well as comparability, and whenever you mention deferred tax, a lot of people put their head in their hands and panic. We're now mixing deferred tax and regulatory balances, which is no easy task. But we do have several issues here that are related. The first one is that by recognising regulatory balances, it may well have a deferred tax implication because we may be creating a mismatch between the carrying value of these things on the balance sheet and the carrying value for tax purposes, which in itself would normally trigger a deferred tax calculation and the recognition of deferred tax. So I think the board need to consider whether you want the deferred tax balances being adjusted for these additional differences that are being created by recognising these balances, which will have an impact not just on the deferred tax balance in the balance sheet, but also the tax expense in profit and loss account. So that's the first issue. There's then an additional layering to that, in that in some regimes, the rate regulator will allow the tax expense of the entity to be included as an allowable cost, which can be recovered by including those costs in the future rates charged to the customers for future sales. Because it's an allowable cost, that will create an additional regulatory balance, which is equivalent to the amount of tax that's paid or payable. Because we then create that additional regulatory balance, Philip's a step ahead, we create an additional difference for deferred tax purposes, which creates additional deferred tax, but that's recoverable. So we create an additional regulatory balance, which is another difference for deferred tax. So we create more deferred tax. And it's wonderful circular calculations, which I know, PK, you've mentioned. In practice,
it's a simultaneous equation.
It's simultaneous equations and it's iterative calculations. And people I know in local
have
gaps.
Have we found the holy grail to unlimited profits?
And this is my personal problem with it. It's not the mathematics, which in themselves is complicated enough, and I think a lot of people would struggle to understand. But what it results in is a grossing up of tax in the P&L account, a grossing up of deferred tax balances in the balance sheet, a grossing up of regulatory balances in the balance sheet as well. And I would question not just the understandability, but the added value of doing that in this circumstance where we're creating an exception for a limited number of entities to recognise these balances. We're trying to isolate as best we can, it's not perfect, but as best we can, to stop it from distorting the other figures in the financial statements, to allow that direct comparability with other entities. So the staff recommendation is that we exempt these regulatory balances from the requirement to calculate deferred tax, to recognise deferred tax.
Daryl?
This is where we start getting into, I think, the points that we were talking about earlier, because to me it feels like if we start with, and I realize this is a stretch, but if we start with the assumption under the standard that we are accepting that these are assets and liabilities.
Can I just say...
We're accepting that these are balances.
We tried to make it very clear.
We're accepting that for the purposes of these standards, these are balances.
Debits
and credits. The treatment of those balances requires that they be treated, that the deferred tax be taken into account on them. Otherwise, in effect, it seems to me, we're misstating the balances that we put on there. And we're misstating them because we're not taking into account something that is a valid consideration of those balances. We kind of cross over then and say, this would be something that would be isolated. It would be something that would form part of those separate lines in the income statement and the balance sheet. From an isolation perspective, it is the deferred tax on those underlying balances. It also seems to me that in local GAAP, you must have some kind of consideration of this in any case. You must have had some thought process to it. And in line with the sort of principles that you were talking about earlier, where we isolate the balances and apply IFRS to our thinking on those balances, it seems to me it should be isolated, but should certainly be applied here. And so the iterative nature, I think there are other items in IFRS that give rise to the same sort of iterative considerations. So it's not unique to this. We've done simultaneous calculations appear elsewhere as well.
And what happens usually?
You do the calculation because it is the correct representational faithfulness of whatever that balance happens to be.
Stephen?
Yeah, I agree with Daryl, I'm afraid. My question would be, let's suppose that eventually, once we've gone through the discussion paper, we do conclude these are assets. We would then put them in, we would then have deferred tax, wouldn't we? So the argument about it being difficult, etc., I think we would dismiss that at the time and we put it in IAS 12. It seems to me that people are going to use the net assets of the business, including the regulatory balances. They're going to use earnings per share, including the charge or credit for the regulatory stuff. And therefore, if they're going to use that information, I think it would be remiss of us to exclude the deferred tax consequences, particularly if you've got regulatory assets and a big balance, and there are some very large balances out there. You put that in, you include it in net assets, and you exclude that potentially large deferred tax liability. I think you're getting a very misleading picture.
I think part of my problem, Stephen, as well, is that the other side of this is not just affecting the regulatory balance lines.
Yeah.
It's affecting the deferred tax line. It's affecting the tax expense line in the P&L account. And it's... We've already decided that the EPS should exclude regulatory items. So my next question, if you want to include these deferred tax impacts, is that we would then need to start isolating the tax as well. So if we're dealing with EPS, it's excluding the regulatory balances and excluding the tax on those regulatory balances.
Yeah, so I would isolate the deferred tax and the tax charge element, which relates to regulatory balances, either separating them, putting them next to the rest of the tax, or indeed putting them within the regulatory item or next to the regulatory item. That might be a bit of a stretch because you're shifting stuff around the financial statements, but I would isolate it, yes.
I see a lot of nodding heads. Okay.
Yeah, very quickly, Jane, this is no surprise to you. I told you that there is simultaneous equation to take care of this issue. Think about it, though. The assets and liabilities that arise because of this will affect the nature, timing, and uncertainty of future cash flows.
Yeah.
If it's a large balance, there could be a large impact, and that is a very valid thing. The other thing which Steve said and which I spoke to you separately is that show it as net of tax. You know, if you want to isolate, I will not use the word isolate, I will use segregate. So if you want to segregate these things, yeah, put it in the, put it as net of tax. But I don't think we should stop recognizing the deferred tax assets and liabilities consequence.
That's fair enough.
I agree with Steve and Daryl, and I think as far as whether or not it would adjust the deferred tax assets and liabilities in the balance sheet in the normal part, it seems to me you could isolate the deferred tax asset and liability associated with this and put it into the regulatory item line. So it is still isolated. But I think you have to do the tax accounting. Otherwise, it's very misleading.
Mary?
I also support doing the tax accounting, so do not agree with the staff recommendation. But either way, I think the most important thing is to flag this issue about the tax and ask a question about it in the invitation to comment, because I think if we were silent, that people who consider the deferred taxes on regulatory assets, some would continue doing it and put it in that isolated line item, and others wouldn't, and it would be a mess. So I think the big thing is bringing out this question, proposing how to do with it. My preference would be to say do it. And then ask a question about it.
There you go.
Now, assume we can do everything. I asked you about, you already touched the...
We can do everything. We do that all the time.
He's joking.
I want to see, or you give us an explanation about the supplementary disclosure attached to the income statement. You already mentioned it. We have a separate line items in the on the face. Then we'll have a supplementary disclosure and to explain the possible difference. I only want to touch two items to see whether our proposed disclosure will be useful or not. Assume the first line, revenue, based on our normal standards, is 1 million. Based on regulatory regime, will be 500,000. My question is whether it will split. And such kind of question will apply all the items, expense, general expenses, and the others, cost of goods sold. This is my first question, my first item. And the next one is, you already touched, tax expense. The amount is net of regulatory impact or include regulatory impact or two line. Can you explain?
Yeah, I mean, the proposal, because we're trying to get this segregation and we're trying to get the direct comparability for the revenue, if you have, you would recognize revenue in accordance with the revenue standard, which at the moment is IAS 18. So whether you're recognizing regulatory amounts or not, if your revenue was 1 million, then you would show 1 million. If for regulatory purposes it was only 500,000, you would still show revenue of 1 million, and you would have the 500,000 going through your regulatory movement line item.
So,
and the same with tax, which is why we've got this complication with tax. Because this grossing up would normally go through the tax expense, that was my concern, is that we're distorting that tax expense and it's not comparable with others. But if we can separate that out and net that, then that resolves my concern on that particular
issue. So the revenue amount will purely base on our standards. And all the related will go to the last line.
Yes.
And then my question to you is, whether it is useful information of the first line.
I think well, I don't think I'd recommend it if I didn't think it was useful, but I think it is useful because that is that is the number that IFRS would, IFRS says is the appropriate revenue. It reflects your actual activities during the period. It does reflect the services or the goods that you are supplying and what you get back in that exchange transaction. The objectives of the regulator, I think we all acknowledge, can be different from the objectives of general purpose financial reporting. And this is where we get the tension. The regulator's objectives is often to smooth out the impact of real economic events and defer the impact of those to the customer. But it doesn't, I don't think, get away from the fact that you have made sales of a million. Just because the regulator says that, that there will be some adjustment to future prices to compensate for changes in prices, I don't think takes you away from the fact that you have made sales of a million.
Yeah, because, you know, the on the face 1 million in the supplementary disclosure is also 1 million. This is why I ask whether it's useful or not.
Yeah, I think the supplemental information is designed to explain the regulatory impact. So, you know, if you've collected or if you've recognised 1 million, but the regulator says you should only have recognised 500,000, then the impact is you're going to reduce your prices in the future, which, and most local GAPs now that are recognising these things would create a deferred revenue type balance, a liability balance, which then would clearly show up in the supplemental information. So people can see prices will reduce in the future and therefore revenue will decrease in the future when we're selling goods at a lower price.
Do you think that is helpful? I mean, a company really allowing them recognizing asset and liabilities on regular, but not really recognize that in revenues and cost to separate all that. I mean, how should a company make an communication of the earnings if you allowing it on the balance sheet but really mix it all up in the P&L with one line item, it does not fit together. That is, I'm totally with Weigu, man. This does not make a lot of sense.
I think the
is that really useful to estimate future cash flows of that company?
I think we've got a conceptual problem here. And it's something that I know that you've been discussing with the conceptual framework team, and it's this tension of a going concern and what's present and what's future and what we're economically forced to do in the future, and it's all tied up, which is why, you know, we're looking now at an interim standard because we can't answer these questions at this stage. Because the people that argue that these regulatory balances are assets and liabilities is that they think the past event is the fact that we've incurred some costs or we've made some sales and the regulator says that we can recover or pay back these things in the future.
I agree with that, but why don't you saying, okay, you're allowing that and including that in all the P&L and balance sheet line item, and then only say, okay, for comparable purposes, give a disclosure of the major impact in all these line items from the regulatory assets, liabilities, and the consequences. Because otherwise, you have rules for the balance sheet different from the P&L, and all what we discussed here is very, very, very difficult.
Sorry, I'm not sure we are asking for different rules for balance sheet and P&L, because in the balance sheet we're again
asking
for segregation.
It's isolated in your...
Yeah, it's in both.
I thought you were questioning the value of putting all the P&L impacts on a single line item in the P&L as opposed to showing the impact of regular, you know, on the face of the income statement showing revenue as determined under...
I would think that a company,
and I think that's inconsistent with the isolation conclusion.
Yeah, I would imagine a company which you are allowing to recognize regulatory assets and liabilities is also managing their revenues and their costs and everything, including the impact from the regulatory assets and liabilities, depreciation, everything. And
I think the mindset here is this one that, again, we touched on at the beginning. It's that within even the same jurisdiction, we would expect that there are going to be some entities reporting using this standard and some entities reporting not using this standard. Those who are reporting not using the standard may not actually give this additional information, even if they use it, or may not report this way, even if they use that information as part of their mindset. And Martin used a phrase earlier when he said that the information is useful for modeling future cash flows, and I think that's the case for both entities that use this and for entities that don't use this. The point is that we've decided, and I think we've decided correctly, that if an entity chooses not to use this standard, we haven't added additional disclosure for them. So we need to get a common reference point for both sets of entities. And the common reference point then is what this isolation of line items is about. I mean, I just in thinking this through, the way that I would have thought a lot of entities may choose to display this in their disclosure is to have a three-column income statement. IFRS excluding this, IFRS regulatory income statement, and a total income statement as part of the notes. I think I'm correct in saying that we wouldn't allow that on the face. But that does get them the ability to have both sets of information available to users to understand and to compare those who are and those who aren't.
Can I just add a point here as well? One of the criticisms that I've heard of some local gaps that do allow this regulatory treatment is that it is often the disclosures that come with it, apart from the items that are included within other things like property, plant and equipment we've discussed in the past, you can often see the regulatory balances, because if it doesn't fit within PP&E or something else, they are shown as separate assets and liabilities in those regimes. The problem comes in the profit and loss account, where it often isn't clear which line items have been impacted. And I have had some messages where some people are not sure whether entities are adjusting the revenue line or are they adjusting the cost line, the expenses line. Some cases they might be adjusting the finance income line or the finance expense line. And it's very difficult to compare entity to entity in the profit or loss account. It's easier in the balance sheet, but not in the profit and loss account. So I think our recommendations are actually adding additional value to entities in this respect, because we are trying to say, look, let's get one treatment for everybody, and we'll disclose, albeit in the notes, but at least in the notes people can see whether it's revenue, it's cost, which type of costs, etc.
Okay, Tuck, and let's then try to...
I agree with staff's recommendation. We should stay on just asset only. We should not allow to recognize tax asset and liability. Because I think this is interim standard. We are going to tackle this rate-regulated standard anyway. So it's just for the short period of time. And we decided that we should isolate the impact, segregate the impact. So it's a very limited amendment. And once we start recognizing the impact of coming from the recognizing this rate-regulated assets, so it would be endless. So in the end, local GAAP would hijack IFRS itself. It would no longer be IFRS anymore. So therefore, although I think it's very odd to recognize asset only and not recognizing any tax liability or something, deferred tax, it's odd. However, I think we should live with it, because it is a limited amendment for the short period of time. So I agree with the staff.
I think the major leaning of the board was not to agree with the staff recommendations to require the tax liability recorded. Can I see who is in agreement with what I just said?
And with the incentive, not with the staff recommendation.
12. Okay.
Okay, thanks, Hans. And the last item is really a kind of residual catch-all item. There are some other standards. I've mentioned one already, IS 21. The others, IS 10 on events after the reporting date, where they apply to balances generally. So we've already mentioned if you've got a regulatory balance, you've identified it within your internal record keeping system, but it's in a foreign currency, it's not in your functional currency, or it's not in your presentational currency, how do you get that into your IFRS financial statements? What we're recommending is that we put some guidance within the interim standard itself. We don't touch any of these other standards at all, which I think tallies with what we spoke about earlier. So we just put some guidance within the standard to say, in those circumstances where you've got a general IFRS standard, you just apply that in the same way as you would to other balances that you're recognising in accordance with IFRS. So for foreign currency, you would identify, you know, which method of translation you use using the guidance that's already there in IS 21.
Nobody disagrees?
I'll wait for the ED to come back.
Yeah, I mean, some of these things, yeah, operationally, I think the ED will hopefully, you know, let us know whether these are practical operational suggestions, but people are translating already.
Okay. It brings us to the final paper of this week.
It does, yes.
There's another paper.
13B. 13B is quite a short paper, and we are no longer talking about the interim standard. We are now going back to the main rate-regulated project, where we're starting this with a research phase, and we're trying to identify what are the economics of rate regulation, and then use that to flow into how does that match the rights and obligations, how are they enforceable, does that then match the definitions of assets and liabilities, which will tie in with the work that's been done on the conceptual framework project. One of the things that I've been struggling with in trying to do these research is getting sufficient fact patterns on which to base discussions about the rights and obligations and how they're enforced. So paper 13B is asking the board for permission to issue a very short request for information. In accordance with the due process handbook, this is just an optional due process step. It doesn't need to be done, but I think it would be very helpful to help us scope the discussion paper and to get sufficient fact patterns to get some good discussion going in the discussion paper. And the due process handbook that's recently been approved by the trustees recommends a 60-day comment period for a factual type of request for information like this. So I just want to ask the board if you've got any comments or questions. Paragraph 13 sets out the questions that we're planning to ask in this request for information. The rest of the document would just set a little bit of background context for these questions, but we're not asking for opinions, we're just asking for fact patterns.
Isn't a very important question how to be able to answer the question whether there is an asset, how certain it is that the consumer of, that there will be consumption to the same extent or at all of the goods or services delivered by the rate regulated company. Yes. There may be a very dramatic shift in consumer behavior, which even though the rate regulated entity is allowed to ask a high price, that there are simply no takers, or many fewer than had been anticipated. I think that is one of the main questions that trouble me.
So key points.
Yeah, it's a good point. We could build that perhaps into paragraph 13D talks about how are rights enforced and obligations settled. So, yes, we've got a right to increase prices in the future, but how do we make sure there's enough volume of sales?
And have there been examples in the past where such
gas distribution industry, the gas distribution, there are big shifts among different companies. Even here in London, you can easily shift from one provider to another one.
Yeah, but here you don't have, you have competition.
Yes.
And that, so you don't need rate regulation.
But there are markets where there was no competition, but because of the political pressure.
Or there can be a massive shift from gas consumption to electricity consumption. And maybe two completely different companies.
Yes.
Mary?
Support the request for information. That the only suggestion I have comes up kind of in respect of paragraph 14 and your paper, which is rather than just ask the world for information about their regimes, I think it should have a framing question that perhaps is not neutral, which is for those regimes that you think should impact the recognition of assets and liabilities, income and expense under IFRS, please provide this information. Because I think we only want people to provide it about things for which they think it would be useful to have the regulation impact the accounting. And we're not saying just because you think it should, we will, but just give us information only about those rather than every, bank deposit protection. That wouldn't be rate regulation, but, some really oddball ones that we aren't looking for if people think that it should not be in the scope of a rate-regulated standard.
Yeah, good suggestion. I mean, we'll obviously include a similar question in the discussion paper as well, because we don't want to inadvertently include or exclude particular types of regulated activity, but at least we can get a flavor for it if we build it in here.
We're not asking them which ones they think qualify or should qualify, but rather where do they think it would be helpful to have the accounting reflect the rate regulation and then provide us information about those schemes.
Yes, thank you. On these questions, maybe some more questions on users' perspective. Once in a PEP distributed a kind of analysis of all utility companies in the world, that paper is very exciting and interesting how these users use this information on regulatory companies. So basically most of the, you include a disclosure issue about the user's perspective. But before finalizing this question, maybe we will talk with Pat, because he has such a good knowledge about the uses of the regulatory information, assets and liabilities.
Well, it's about the same point. There are many entities which are rate-regulated that did not recognize or stopped recognizing assets and liabilities, and still they have to communicate performance to their investors. So how do they deal in communicating performance with the issue of rate-regulation? Are there aspects of their communication that we could analyze at the time we decide and to see what, is it better to go through disclosures, specific disclosures? Is it better to for the investors to understand the performance?
I think in this paper it's a request for information, not a request for views.
Yeah.
And I do think we need to be clear on that.
Information might be how do you currently, if you don't have such assets, how do you currently communicate on aspects of your regulation?
Yeah.
Stephen?
I wouldn't do that or Chungro. I would keep it very much limited to information about the regimes. And as soon as you start going down that route, where do you stop? And these are issues for the discussion paper, I feel.
Okay.
Sorry, can I just check then, just because we now have a split between those that think we should include a user section in the question and those that don't. So perhaps if I could just get a clear steer.
I think we can do that in the discussion paper.
We will do it in the discussion paper.
We will do it at the discussion paper anyway.
So it will be. This is not the right time.
Yeah.
Now you are collecting facts.
Yeah, so we'll stick to...
Okay.
Now go away, never come
back. Thank you very much. I'll try not to. You're going to be sick of it.